Hello.
Hello.
Would you please start by stating your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
Okay, so my name is Kenita Placid. Today is the 27th of January, 2022. It's currently 2:39, and I'm located in the island of Saint Lucia in the Caribbean.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial, share alike?
Yes, I have given my consent.
Would you please start by just introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening to this? What would you want them to know about you and the place you're speaking from?
Well, I hope that the Caribbean is located in between North and South America. We are small islands. Well, most of us would probably say we are countries too, because equivalent to one vote at the UN. But we are dealing with the remnants of the colonial era, where in our country we still have a governor general because the queen is still head of state, even if we are independent nations, especially in the English-speaking Caribbean. And so, with our countries, we are still working to remove a lot of the colonial rhetoric that's still within our constitution, such as buggery laws and gross indecency laws restricting same-sex individuals from being able to engage in loving relationships. And so, as we continue that fight, we look at the safety and well-being of LGBT persons. Although the islands are small, there are a number of, I would say, very good economic factors, because I think the beaches, the sand, the seas, the warmth that you get from the islands is something that I would invite everybody down to.
And thinking about you as a person, as an individual, who are you? Who am I speaking with? Tell me a little bit about you.
Well, for much too long, I guess that's a question I always ran away from. But I think I was born to the native island of Saint Lucia. I work across the Eastern Caribbean. To my family, I am my mother's last child. I am the fifth born of the family. And I have been in activism for over 16 years. I don't particularly like labels, but I think the label that most recently I felt a little more comfortable with is somewhere along the lines of non-binary, gender non-conforming kind of label, but only if and when necessary. I still prefer absolutely no labels if I can pass with it. And yeah, I think my work has been for the last 15 years predominantly working on the advancement and rights of LGBT persons. I have just reached, currently I'm over 40 and still looking like 25, so I'm thankful for that. And I think I've created a global family, so I could call almost in any country where there's somebody I would call a friend or chosen family. Over the last couple of years of engagement in activism.
Would you tell me a story about living in the pandemic?
I think the pandemic hit us, almost like a climate change, one of the climate change systems. It wasn't expected, we didn't see it coming. There was no preparation, and it was here. And I think one of the things that really hit was, having a year of planning just swept under your feet and trying to figure out how to get these things done or how to even reprogram it. But as an individual, I found myself rethinking not just how to do these things, but how do you stay safe with something that you do not fully understand how it gets you? Because technically, you get it from even doing nothing, deliberately. Our work took a pinch. Self, mental health and self-esteem, self-confidence, those things took a hit. And so what I would say is that when the pandemic hit, we started looking out, if we are feeling this way, how are our members feeling and what's happening in the countries? And it was interesting because the team that I work with, unlike most people saying, oh, they are not working, because it's like we went into overdrive of reaching people, overdriving, checking in and making sure people were fine. Although we were working remotely, we checked in every day because we understood living alone for some of us also carried very heavy, heavy sentences, especially for those who were social butterflies. And then even those who lived with family was not necessarily accepting or comfortable, and then that also provided a different situation to deal with. So being creative, being strategic, coming out of this, working through it, is something that we continuously do. We did, we are doing, and we're not sure when we're going to be stopping.
Would you say a bit more about what those check-ins look like, sound like?
All right, so I think we can look at three levels of check-in. One was with the board, one was with the team, and one was with membership. And so I think with the board, it was more strategic as to where the organization stand, where we are, do we, you know, what was the financial health at the time? Can we manage? Do we need to let go anybody? Are any of the projects going to be affected by what we do? And so on and so forth. And those checks came in regularly for me with my chair, because we needed to make sure that, you know, when with all the loss of jobs and with the shutdown of countries, it was something that we had to monitor. The Caribbean is one that is highly dependent on the tourism industry, you know, flights, hotels, and even a lot of the services that are offered, restaurants and so on, are more highly designed for guests coming in. And so with COVID, that was a major shutdown. And what we got was, when I spoke about loss of jobs, a number of our LGBT folks actually worked within the tourism industry. And so when hotels cut back or hotels closed, that was a hit to the economy in many ways, but particularly to our LGBT persons who might be just going paycheck to paycheck and has no kind of savings to really help them to cover this time of no pay. And the team got to check in on a daily, as we do so once a week when we're in office. But being away, we actually checked in every morning to see how people were doing, what they were working on, how they were dealing with the day. Some days we had to offer staff mental health break days because, you know, I think there were at least five of the staff members who actually live alone. And so that meant different things to people. Some of them mobile and some of them not. Those who are not mobile taking public bus. And so had to think about, if we had to have an in-person interaction for some reason, what's the risk of that? And so it really took a lot of rethinking every movement you make, where you go, how you go. And, you know, these were the kind of discussions we had on our team meeting apart from our actual work plan. There were some things we were able to move from in-person to online, and it kind of flew our online presence from maybe a panel discussion once a month to basically having an activity almost every week, whether it was a training, a discussion, a seminar, a check-in, even with our membership. So those things had to be now reworked in our work plans. And so with the team, we also realized that we started doing some exercises, team building exercises, to just help people navigate the mental health, the energy, their focus, their patience. Because a lot of our work actually depended on our members responding to certain things or attending certain things. And so the next layer of check-in came in, which was checking with our membership, having one-on-ones, having group sessions, checking in to see how they are meeting the needs of the community that they are serving. And what does that look like? How does that affect them? Where is the funding deficits? Where are the human resource deficits? And then with a lot of the Caribbean islands, particularly those we serve, we were able to look at a lot of our organizations, give them information like when Outright was doing the COVID response grants. Looking at global giving funding platform and trying to raise some money on there too, where we can continuously give partners to give money to their communities on the ground by providing care packages for persons who needed food, by providing transport allowance or communication allowance for those who needed that. And so I felt like between the March of 2020, when our countries closed down to present, these have been like the whole mobilizing structures in terms of getting our people taken care of, because we had to take care of our membership, which is the organization, in order for the organizations to be able to take care of the people on the ground.
Would you be willing to sort of briefly outline the structure of the organization? So, who are your members? Who's on the board? What is the sort of core of what your organization does?
So, for the Eastern Caribbean Alliance, we currently have eight board members, sorry, and they are located in different countries. Our chair is from St. Martin, our vice chair from Grenada. We have a treasurer from St. Croix, our treasurer from St. Lucia. We have other members of the board in St. Kitts, Barbados, St. Martin, Saba, I believe. The structure of the secretariat, which is based in St. Lucia, it has five staff that's currently based in St. Lucia, but we also have one that's based in Suriname. With our membership, we are actually we currently work across nine islands, having 26 organizations registered with us. And our organizations, we have 15 organizations that serve in LGBTQ specific populations. And then we have another 11 that's serving women, girls, HIV, youth at risk, and general human rights. So we work at those intersections of the issues that we're working with, commonality being a lot around gender, human rights, and climate change. And I think when we look at those organizations, we would see the organizations are actually represented in Antigua and Barbuda, Commonwealth of Dominica, Barbados, Grenada, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, St. Lucia, St. Croix, which is part of the US Virgin Islands, and St. Martin, St. Martin, which is half Dutch, half French. These are the islands that we currently serve as part of ECAD.
What does the word pandemic come to mean to you?
I mean, when I heard, I think it's nothing new. We have been living through from 1985, 1983 to present with a pandemic around, with the HIV pandemic. And so we have been living through one pandemic and now having another added. I think it's nothing new, but what we definitely saw was a design that's totally different. And when I say a design, I mean when we watch HIV, HIV could only be transmitted through basically willful actions in most situations. And with this pandemic, it felt like there was no running away from COVID. If the wind blew in the wrong direction, it may come to you, which had less of a control mechanism of whether you are choosing to get it or not. And so, I told people I felt for the Caribbean, we have had three pandemics for a lot of our lives, which is HIV, which is climate change, and now COVID, because every year we have to think about the impact of climate change in the Caribbean, especially with the hurricane season, and what damages and what losses we get then. So I don't think pandemic is like a new word to us. It's not a stranger. I think it just brought itself in a different fold that it required really rethinking how you navigate people. And as human beings, we, as soon as we were born, we were pretty much taught to socialize. So asking people to then distant brought a totally different challenge, which was basically against the nature of the people in question. So that was an interesting one, and it's still an interesting one to try to dissect.
I would love to hear any and all thoughts on what working in HIV activism helped you see at sort of the early stages of COVID-19, where what comparisons make sense, which comparisons don't, like anything on that, I would just be so happy to hear.
I mean, I felt so many things were similar to the response to this pandemic and HIV. The not knowing, the fear mongering, the rumors, the counter information that, led to whether people believe or not believe things can be done. And especially the whole 5G story. That said that, the virus is about governments trying to control people. Maybe later on we might find out something different, but right now, when I look at our response medically, in most of our countries, the same department which handle HIV is the same department that actually handle COVID. And there were a number of things that were actually put to the table that are just so similar you cannot take away. And I think one of the biggest examples I could give is just the contact tracing. Who have you been around? It's just like HIV asking you, who have you been with? Who did you sleep with, or who did you share a needle with, or then having to trace that step. We look at the response in terms of the care and treatment and the isolation that have taken place. I think even in terms of the protocols of trying to really address the issue without necessarily knowing enough about it. We have made some errors, but I think HIV really taught us a lot about protocols and measures, health and safety, that was brought into dealing with the COVID, setting up stations. And I felt we were a little late in isolating the cases, especially when we were bringing it into a hospital with other persons who already had situations that may have compromised them and then didn't understand how it may have transmitted or where things may have gone wrong. So I do take that as one of the lessons learned, especially with a new pandemic. We also saw responses in terms of countries. But one of the things that also hit me very hard was when vaccinations came around. And although they created a system to allow equal vaccination access, we did see where Global North bought off more than needed, and left Global South to think to peddle for themselves in terms of when or how people are actually going to get vaccinated. So where Global North countries were saying we have millions of people vaccinated, there were still countries who had not seen not one vaccine because it was not available to be bought for them. And then you had when they realized vaccines were going to be expiring, then they tried to donate off to countries to get try and get it used as quickly as possible. So again, we also saw that level of Global North, Global South divide in terms of access of medical equipment, of vaccinations, and sometimes even information.
I don't know if this question will make sense, but could you say something about what that feels like to be living that inequity and watching it?
I mean, to connect some of this, I think this is why there's a look that the Caribbean is still dual country. We're part of the global south, we're part of the divide. We also have a higher ratio of black people or brown skinned people here in this region than there is white. And so when I think about it, I think this is why a lot of our calling and concerns are also along the lines of Black Lives Matter. But we also have to take that back into our history of slavery, our history of colonization, because these things are so deep-rooted. It's not just 20 years ago. It is years of carrying it through. And then now it is still informally. There are still snippets of it because the culture, the cultural norms, the societal norms have been developed around a colonial history. So it takes a lot of breaking, rethinking, re-educating. And even I, as an individual who challenge the norms, many times I have to challenge myself to rethink why I'm thinking a particular way because we have been socialized in it. And so we also have to check ourselves as leaders that we are actually breaking free from that some of the old narrative around colonialism that we still tend to carry. It is not easy to navigate. Even when we are looking for funding for this region, it's the least funded, one of the least funded regions. And even if it's considered to be like even for HIV, the Caribbean was the second highest, rate of infection. We still found that the investment in the region, because the islands are so small, until they actually unified to form a regional body, very little attention was or is actually paid to them. And even with the LGBT organizing, EKID is an umbrella organization simply because, again, we recognize that a lot of our members were not necessarily getting core support or have access to funding because the populations they're going to reach are so small that it's not necessarily striking on the radar of the funders that we need to fund them. So it's continuous and it's not in one day of work. But to say that when we speak about racial disparities, we still have to look at, even in the Caribbean, even if they may not be racism, there's still colorism, because different shades of dark will still get you in problems. Those who are lighter shade or can pass as white would still have more privilege. And it is something that is still existent. When expatriates from the UK, US, Europe come to these parts, they may be still paid a higher salary than a manager who has been here managing for years. And, you know, but nobody is going to call that out, because they come from the global north with more experience. That is what that is indicated. So we still have a number of things that we still have to work on in terms of how our people see and appreciate themselves, and continuously bring others up, create space for others, and not just close it out to who we think looks right or who we think has the money of influence.
Do you remember when you first heard about COVID-19?
Yes. People attended China's birthday or something, or Chinese New Year. And then there was this speak about having an outbreak.
What were your initial reactions?
Well, to be quite honest, at first I didn't have an initial reaction, because I think when we heard about the outbreak, we was just wondering whether it was going to stay in China only. It's when it started popping up different places, especially for people who had traveled, then there was an opinion that it's a rich man's disease, because it's only those who could afford to travel that's going to get affected. But as people came back home infected, they passed it on to their workers, whether it was the gardeners or the cleaners, and then those are quickly got into community faster than the governments could have blinked. And so I think at that point, when countries started shutting down in March, because, you know, we heard of it since the, was it November or December of 2019? But it's when people really, when the big fuss started being made between January and March, and countries started shutting down, it really became a worry. And when the number of deaths started climbing, it was, wow, we are losing people, and we are losing all kinds of people. We as a world have not even done, and this is where my mind started going. When those deaths started climbing, I was pretty worried, because I was saying that we have not even done an assessment of important, I mean, every life matters, don't get me wrong, but those persons who were key persons at the front of research, the lead engineer on a particular project, the technician in this and that, who might have been the best in their field, we have not even done an assessment to understand who we have lost and how that's going to affect productivity. And so coming into end of last year, into this year, where certain products, you cannot get it because the production line is slow or reduced, we have not taken a deep look at the true impact of COVID, which is going to cause, on which has caused, inflation of prices, demand, and availability of goods are on two different levels. And so all of those things are impacting what we get, how we get it, what quality we get it, you know. And that's in goods and services. We have lost some good people. And enough have not even, we cannot even, when we look at a couple billion people lost to the world in a matter of 2 years, And that does not even account for other diseases that's still taking people and all the road accidents and useless murders that people are committing. We have lost a lot of people in our lifetime, that we have not really truly understood the impact beyond where we are now. And I think that's where my thoughts went when I did take it serious, is the people we are losing. The people we are losing.
How have you been accessing services throughout the pandemic?
I have not had to, well, to be quite honest, during this pandemic, I think the services that I've probably accessed most is banking and supermarket. And, for some of our services here in the Caribbean, they are not all electronic. And so still had to think about that. Even for supermarket, with the restriction of number of people in the supermarket, we had to devise. Some people went, finally, there were one or two people doing online orders and stuff, but something that was not very popular in my island before. And so there were some real adjustments in terms of long lines for services. And so if a service was not absolutely necessary, it was struck off my book as not needed now, because some of those lines were really long. So except for supermarket and banking, there was nothing else urgent on my list. So my restrictions came very early for me, in terms of where I was going and where I was not. The other restriction for me was probably because as a activist, especially working sub-regionally, we did a lot of travel, and that became quickly to no travel. So I think back in 2020, I probably had two trips before our lockdown, the last being a case in Barbados. I traveled for the day for, which was the 10th, and then countries locked down like maybe 2 or 3 days after that. So I think it has changed the world of travel and all the expectations. In terms of access to health care, you really had to assess, unless it was something urgent, do you really want to put yourself at risk going to an institution where somebody else might not be as careful as you coming to access it? So it made me rethink all the things that would say, oh, I have to do this today and that today. And it's like, do I really? Is there another form I can do this in? And a lot of the institutions I reached out to find out whether they were apps, whether they were online services that I could have accessed without necessarily having to go into the institution.
What kind of responses did you get?
Well, some of the organizations have set up online services, bank transfers. They really tried to, it was hustle and bustle. Some was already in process of doing it, so they just hastened the pace, and others really tried to create that with the banks where they say, like, you could have only removed $100 a day. They increased that to allow more free flow of transactions online or through ATMs rather than inside. Even the utilities company gave online options for payments. So there were things that were done to make things easier, and they have continued it so far. And for one or two things that other things like insurance and stuff at the time did not have that option, or they were not in that space yet, we had to then create a conversation around, can you do payments for 2 free months, and so that you don't have to go in every month kind of thing. So those, like, there were a lot of conversations, particularly for St. Lucia, some of the smaller islands. In all of the islands, there were movements towards that. And then so our team had a conversation around the populations we serve, and how things needed to be done, wire transfers to them to make sure they get it. And we had to be working a lot with our banking officer to make sure we were still executing some of our projects and support to our members without delay.
This goes back to something you had mentioned earlier, but you had talked about Black Lives Matter, and I'd like to just ask you to say anything more about that.
I think sometimes in a fast-paced life, where things are happening on a daily, things are going on, you are distracted with a number of different things. They have some headlines that would pass you. But I think what we would have seen during the COVID, people would say there's an increase in gender-based violence, there's an increase in violence against Black people, and so on and so forth. I think in this world, in this 2020 to 2022, there was something that was vastly different. These incidents happened. They were documented. They were reported. Social media was on a buzz because everybody kept connected because they wanted to know what was happening out there. And so the online community took note. You know, not that they didn't take note before, but for those who didn't, they had a minute to pause because they were not in a flight, they were not in a train, they were at the system where either their children, their partner, somebody in the house was bringing attention, or they themselves passed it on social media. And the outrage about these things still happening, whether it is police brutality, whether the justice system failure of our Black lives, whether it is even our neighbors who are not necessarily doing what's appropriate, you know. So I think that when we look at what was happening in the Caribbean, even with Black lives, there is a sense that even if most of us are Black, there is still that mentality around who is more of a criminal, a Black man or a white man, that still registers here because of the element of power of the white skin. And so that impact is still here. And so we could have married some of the issues and the injustices that the US, the UK, Canada, Europe was then rising up above, but mostly UK and US, where we were actually, because even for us here, say in St. Lucia, we actually had a St. Lucian who was actually killed by a police officer in the US. And that case went on for a very long time, we consider, for justice to be served. You know, something about mistaken apartments. And so even then, we have to consider the practice here, but we also have citizens that may be residing in that global north where other issues are taking place. Just because of how dark you are, your level of education, whether somebody like how you smile or don't smile, or how bright, how knowledgeable you may be getting yourself in trouble for no reason, or somebody may be abusing their position of power to keep you on the low. So it's something that is continuous, and we are always saying that we have to continue understanding what's happening up there, but also look at our realities. And our realities sometimes match, even if cultural and social context might be different. But and at this point, I could tell you that the Caribbean, as a Caribbean, even if our legacy sits with the Dutch, with the French, with the English as colonial masters of the past, the most influential country on the things that we do and how we do it is actually the US at this point. And so we continuously have to look at the narratives of what's happening in those other countries and keep looking at how our people are interpreting it and reading it and navigating around it. As we push for the changes in policies and protections.
Would you give a few examples of things that were being watched, happening in the US and how those were being interpreted?
Well, I mean, for one, with the whole Trump administration and some of the rules on migration and immigration and immigrants, that spoke for itself. His behavior around women and sexism, and the patriarchy that he pushed out around the narratives that were used, that people then believe that coming out and talking, bashing Black people were accepted. The service to Black people, I mean, that spoke for itself. We certainly saw a difference in, I mean, when we look at the Bush administration to the Clinton administration, Obama administration, and then Trump, that was like, oh, that was the trashiest of all. You know, the impact of his rules probably, and maybe in the era that it came, hit hard. And now we're looking to see how Biden is trying to clean that up, or if that even, or if that is. But we still have to monitor, not because they look good, it means that it's all good. Still have to keep looking at the administration. So some of those things actually had impact for our own countries in terms of how we speak to the US. We also had some issues with the US, even in terms of, even during COVID, where we had shipments that was held back by the US because they transferred through the US, and they took years to come down to the Caribbean because they were held by the Trump administration, because it was COVID supplies, and they felt that they could have kept what they wanted. So there were major arguments between the Caribbean and the US administration. And I think things are only now beginning to get good again. So I think that we can see definite strains of different rhetoric, conversations from Trump, his tweets that the news tend to have carried every day, carried into our news in terms of the president of the US, this and that, and this and that. And it's just like, my God, it's not happening. But it was. And so we too had to then turn around and hold our governments accountable, in terms of engagements and looking at how those things impact the populations we serve.
How has access to things like testing been?
I think the government have done a pretty good job in terms of testing. However, when there are the waves, we have seen some large numbers go up and down around the testing. So it's one that in the beginning of testing, a lot of our tests had to go to Trinidad or Barbados for confirmations. But I think then we got the right equipment and things have been done internally. And so that makes getting of test results much quicker. You can get test results with a turnaround of 24 to 48 hours, whether PCR or antigen. And so that has become, they have gotten much better.
What does the word health mean to you?
Health.
Yes.
Well, I think when I think about health, I break it down into general health and mental health, because more often than not, mental health is not taken into consideration, which is different from medical health. And so when I think about health, I tend to break it down and look at the different aspects. Health, well-being, comes hand in hand, thinking about the overall feel, look, and understanding of the individuals or subject.
What are some of the things you want for your own health?
I think the biggest thing for health is peace of mind, stress-free, a good exercise routine, When you ask that question, it's very broad for me, so I can take it in many directions. But I think being healthy as part of the health concept, which means that in good medical condition, my liver, kidney, and so on works. My bodily parts works. And then there's the mental aspect that looks at how I breathe, how I sleep, how I think, what's my routine of peace of mind. And then we just look at the everyday understanding of the individual in terms of social interactions and behaviors of how are you at peace and how are you happy? Part of health checks.
What does the word safety mean to you?
Safety. For me, safety means secure. It means that when I think about safety, I think about a roof over my head, food availability, to some level, economic livelihood, which means that you're working or doing something that gives you some level of funding to maintain yourself. And I think about being in a place where no harm can come to me, whether it be physically, psychologically, or cyber.
Thinking about this sort of small, narrow world that has discussed safety under COVID, what are some of the things that make you feel safer, if anything?
Safer during COVID.
Yes.
Safer during COVID. The ability to work from home and not having to go out. I think knowing that more so now than in the beginning, masks are actually available. Because I know in the very early days when this started and it wasn't expected, there was shortages of masks at times. Which mask is safe enough? Knowledge is also important to me. Understanding the information given, that it transfers from information to knowledge. And I think having people that you can talk and work with, that you are able to create strategies around well-being, safety, health, is the other aspect. I think about comfort.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
How I feel about
The immediate future.
I think the only, I mean, when we look at life, the only constant in life, and it's something that my grandmother always told me from time I was a little person growing up, is that the only constant in life is change. And so as we look at change and we look at what is changing and how things are changing, we have no choice as a people but to adapt. So human beings, one of their unique qualities is adaptability. And so I think that as change continue to happen, people will continue to adapt and to move forward. With the immediate future, like the HIV pandemic, we have been living with it. And very soon we will be living with the COVID pandemic as well. Maybe with more understanding of how to continue taking care of ourselves. It would be interesting that, wearing masks in a lot of public places was illegal before, and now it would be the legal thing to do. In terms of how I feel, I mean, as long as we're alive and we have breath of life, it means that we are going to be doing something to continue existing on this world. And so that's where I see us going, just continuing to live and exist, and adapting.
I'd love to hear about the shift from masks having been illegal in spaces to it becoming legal.
Well, I think for a very long time, China, probably with their pollution, I realize a lot of Chinese, when they travel, would always have, or should I say, people from that part of the world, because it may not just be Chinese, it could be Japanese, Koreans as well, Asians, would normally have the mask on for different reasons, but particularly for the air. Even in parts of India, they have masks on wearing all the time, as a protection. But I think that when we look at COVID, I said that mask would be a thing of today, because I think that with the measures, knowing that it is still going to be around for a while, we'll have some people that will not wear masks or will stop wearing it, but we have some people who are concerned about it. And so whenever so often we'll have to continue drawing that line between those that want to continue wearing it and those that don't. But I think that it may become a way of life, in terms of things that are going to continue popping up, that we will need to continue at different intervals having to mask up, one mask or another.
What are some of your hopes for a longer-term future?
Truth be told, I don't know. I think the world is developing, it's moving, is evolving. We are hoping to see more out of our youth. We are trying to see that it's the world today is actually the youth owner of tomorrow. But I'm not sure what we are leaving for the youth to actually build on. I'm not even sure the youth is taking on their responsibilities seriously enough. And they may have one or two, but then what does that mean for the majority? We certainly have seen a difference in how people have children. And so the number of new births a year certainly have dropped. When we look at our grandmother, our grandparents who had 11 and 15 children, to their children only having maybe three or four themselves, that already break down the death and youth ratio. And at one point, I mean, even for the Caribbean, it was one where that pyramid was absolutely wrong, where we had a whole set of adults and not enough youth to actually take care of them. But we also have to face the reality that some of our youth are also dying much younger, where we still have people getting to the 1780s and 90s. Some of our youths are not even making it to 30. They still die in their youth. And so I think that's a little problematic in terms of our maths of the world that exists beyond us. But I think in terms of hopes and real hopes is thinking through how we can change systems, how we can improve systems that allow for more out of the box thinking and revolution of theories and practices that better people's lives and not just money in the richest pocket.
What are some of the ways that you've been taking care of yourself over the last few years?
Over the last few years, there are two main things that I have actually done. I still work a lot, but I tend to try to have an exercise routine. So if the gyms are closed, I'm walking on the road, I'm going for walks, I'm taking a dip to the beach. If the gyms are open, I have a trainer that I'll work with once a day for 5 days a week, and then the weekend I'd still go for some long walks. Other than that, I now have a beautiful collection of cactus that I groom, and loving my garden. I think that's the two things, gardening and personal exercising, that also comes with proper eating for me over the particularly over the last 2 years.
Can I ask how your relationship to touch has changed over the course of the pandemic?
What is that?
A relationship with touch?
Yeah, I was about to ask you, what is touch again?
Right.
No, I think I don't think I've been around a lot of people to say that I know I have tested this, but it does feel like being around two people drains my energy quickly now. And being home, getting some work done on my laptop, watching a movie on Netflix, I still keep my office hours from 9:30. From 9 to 4 o'clock, I'm at my desk doing stuff. Some days I'm there a little early or a bit later, depending on what I have to deliver on. But I think that thinking about those bigger spaces where we would hug people and be with people, it feels like it's just gonna be a nod of the head or a bump of the face. And that should be cool enough. I don't know how it's gonna be because really I've not been in a space with too many people for me to figure it. But the last space I was in, I think there was a meeting with probably 15 persons, well spaced out. We said hello, but there were no hugs. So my relationship to touch, I guess, is exclusively just to my partner at the moment and not anybody else.
What's partnership been like during the pandemic for you?
Well, partnership, general partnership or personal partnership?
Either that you'd be willing to answer. I was thinking context of the last answer about touch.
Right. I think that partnerships during the last, I think what, for me, when we look at partnerships generally, I think we, there was a number of touch base with people that probably we would have seen at conferences, didn't. And so there were one or two calls like, hey, how you good? There are some people I could really say checked in on me and I checked in on them. There are a number of people that we have not touched base in a while. And so, this year I found myself like just sending out a few texts and just checking in with people and making sure they're good. Checking in with families, them and their families. Personal partnership, I think for me has been interesting. It's a long distance relationship, and so that already has a distance in its nature. And so COVID, I think what COVID tried it on was us not being able to make practical plans of when we would see each other again, with different protocols and different shutdown. And I think that was the struggle. But overall, we ended up with more Zoom meetings and stuff. I guess we went into more of a fast forward of online meetings, which kept us both busy. And just navigating that and still being able to connect with each other. I think that's where that was and is. Happy to say that we can plan again, just knowing the protocols at least, that it, the risk is not as high as before, I think.
This is my second last question. So we know that all of the scientific research is happening, right? There are scientists working on vaccines, there are virologists studying the virus, but there's also a very human social part of the COVID experience. I'm wondering what you think people in the humanities and the social sciences could be doing to help us understand that human side of the moment we're going through.
I think what can be done is probably just more of the stories to really understand. Because, there is like a little bit of a discrimination against somebody who have had COVID or people say, oh, you have COVID. But knowing somebody have COVID actually tells you, okay, I'm dealing with you, your mask is on, my mask is on, here's what to do, than to think that you're talking to somebody without a mask because they're vaccinated and they have no COVID. So I think they are missing a lot of the human stories around, not just the scary stuff about the impact of how you felt when you had it, but what was your recovery like? How did your friends and family respond and support you? I think these aspects are missing in terms of making it a human story instead of a disease story, a virus story. Everything is around the virus at the moment. What you felt, how you felt, other than, but what about how I survived it? And what my life or how I've been living, what I've done differently to change or to help boost my immune system. Those kind of things I think are things that are missing out. When someone has a fever, we think about taking a fever reducer. But how about, a 5, 10 minute walk at high energy that would allow you to just sweat your body out and let it, do its own. So there are also things to help boost your system without all the medication that we also could highlight in terms of things one can do to help, other than just stay inside or wash your hands. I think we have to send out a few more messages, because we as human beings tend to be, we have an automatic reaction to being told what we should do. And so we tend to do the opposite. And we also have to look at what is it that we can recommend for different people, different parts of the world. The message might be the same, but some might also be, would also be made specifically to that country, depending on whether they are First Nations, whether they are Indigenous people, sorry, or whether they are, of a certain social background. Certain things create spaces where you can make tailored messages. But generally, I think the humanities need to bring the humanity of the disease, which of the virus, which is beyond the virus, how people really are affected and how lives continue with and without it.
This is my last question. I want you to imagine speaking to a historian in the future, so someone listening to this who never lived through COVID. They don't know what this was like. What would you tell them they need to remember about this moment? What stories would you tell them cannot be forgotten?
I would probably say that when COVID started, the information that was coming out was very medical and not everybody understood it. So always remember that we are speaking to people who are not necessarily of a medical background when we are putting messages out. Also remember that there are lessons learned from the past. And so dig the archives as quickly as possible and understand some of this. To marry the information and some of the practices that are needed. But more so, it's always easy to come from the head, from the top to the bottom, but sometimes we also have to understand people as people. The humanity in everyone is different. Understand that a pandemic of any nature affects all people. But remember that those below the poverty line, more often than not, would be hit harder, especially with less access to resources. COVID-19 is not the only pandemic, has not been the only pandemic, and will not be the only one. But how we remember to be humane in the process of a pandemic is going to go a long way in terms of people jumping on board, being part of the process and being part of the change.
I want to thank you so much for the generosity of your time and the gift of your answers. And those are all of my questions, but please, if there's anything more that you would like to say about your experiences of COVID-19 or the last few years in general, please take the space to do so.
Yeah. And I mean, if when subscribing, there's anything that is unclear and you need to come back to me, you have me on WhatsApp. It's kind of easier to get me to respond than email. So keep me abreast.
Perfect. I'll reach out.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you.